It's nice to be able to talk in front of you guys once more. So you're probably wondering what this picture is. It's a picture of a chaotic renormalization group flow or cascade, which I'll talk about more later on. But it also sort of gets to, well, at least a little bit of the humorous motivation of what I'm going to tell you about. Last summer, I was getting a little tired of writing papers with equations and text, and I decided that my next paper would have a nice color picture, or maybe more than one. And so this is one of the nice color pictures in this paper that appeared on chaotic duality in string theory. But more seriously, motivation. Most of my work recently has been triggered by some desire to learn about strongly coupled gauge theories from geometry, sort of what's behind most of what I'm going to talk about today. So just by way of a little bit of history, there's this old example of gauge gravity duality, this Klebanov-Strassler solution, this KS solution, which has yielded very interesting connections between confining gauge theory on one side and geometry on the other. In particular, this confining gauge theory had chiral symmetry breaking, maybe of interest to people who are not so strongly motivated by these kinds of questions. This KS solution was also, I think, step one in construction of this KKLT solution, which we heard about so much last fall, this Kalash, Kashrou, Linde, Trivedi solution. And getting to what I'm going to talk about today, I'm interested in what can we learn about from related gauge gravity constructions? What can we, how far can we push this Klebanov-Strassler paradigm, this KS example? What can we learn from it? And what I'm going to talk about today, I'm going to talk a little bit about these chaotic renormalization group flows, a picture of which you saw in the previous transparency, and also these duality walls. Now, duality walls were something that I guess was invented or discovered by Matt Strassler several years ago. There have been many subsequent papers by Bartomeu Fiol, by Hanani and collaborators, by Johannes, who's in the audience. And they're very interesting. So the outline of my talk, I want to begin by reviewing this KS solution, this Klebanov-Strassler solution. That's going to be the first half. The second half of my talk, I want to give you two very simple examples of these chaotic renormalization group flows. One is constructed from this Herzeburg zero surface. Well, essentially this is going to be a Z2 orbifold of the Klebanov-Strassler solution in some sense. And another very simple example is this complex projective space, this P2 blown up at a point. So this is the second half of my talk, and in the style of car talk, click and clack, Tapper Brothers, the third half of my talk will go towards a deeper understanding of, I hope, what I've talked about before, if I have time. So what I'm talking about here today is based largely on this paper, Chaotic Duality in String Theory, which I wrote with Johannes, who's sitting right over there. Also with Seba Franco, who's a student at MIT, and I think looking for a postdoc, and Yang-Hui He. Yang-Hui He, who is an old student of Hanani and is now at UPenn. And I should also mention a previous paper, which a lot of the review material, I'm going to draw heavily from this previous paper, which was written also by Seba Franco and Yang-Hui He, and also by Pavlos Kazakopoulos, who's another student of Hanani, and by Hanani. Okay. The KS solution, how do we construct this? So this is a picture that's probably very familiar to a lot of you. I want to take a stack of D3 brains, and I want to place them at the tip of a Calabi-Yau cone. So in the style of these usual Calabi-Yau compactifications, all of these examples are going to preserve n equals 1 supersymmetry. Okay, so here's my cone, x. Level surface of the cone I'll call y, and I have these n D3 brains. So what are some simple examples of this construction? Well, there's this original ADS-CFT correspondence, where what we do is we place D3 brains at the tip of the cone Z3. That's not a cone, you say. Well, actually it is, right? If you take, you foliate it by 5 spheres, it's a cone. C3 is a cone over S5. Another very simple example is this conifold, which is a quadric in C4. And it's out of the conifold that we'll build this KS solution. And something that's been occupying a lot of my thought recently is taking X to be something else, anything else, any other Calabi-Yau cone. And we'll see that there are typically sort of two problems when you do this. One is gauge theory. Okay, you pick your favorite Calabi-Yau cone, ask what's the gauge theory living on these D3 brains, typically you have no idea, although sometimes you do. And another problem is geometric. You pick your favorite Calabi-Yau cone. You thought you knew a lot about it, but maybe you didn't really, and you can't really do very much with it. You don't know a metric, for example, or you don't really know the topology. Most of the problems today are going to be gauge theoretic. Okay, so the conifold gauge theory. If I put ND3 brains on top of the conifold, what gauge group do I get? What gauge theory do I get? Well, I get two gauge groups, an SUN and an SUN. I have N equals 1 supersymmetry, as I said before, and I have a bunch of bifundamental matter fields. I have four of them, in fact. I have A1, A2, B1, B2, and they go together to form this quartic superpotential, four of these A's and B's, and that's the conifold gauge theory. So before going on, I want to take a brief moment to review how to construct, how to read a quiver. So this here, this thing here is a quiver, or a Moose diagram, and what do I mean by this? Well, I mean for each node, you have an SUN gauge group, and for each arrow, I have a bifundamental field. So here I actually have two arrows going this way, A1 and A2, two arrows going this way, B1, B2. Bifundamental means what? It means it transforms in, say, the antifundamental of SUN and the fundamental of SUN. Okay. That's the conifold gauge theory. And another important point I want to make before going on is this concept of Seiberg duality, which will be very important for studying these RG flows. So Klebanov and Witten, yeah, I'm really sort of giving all the credit to Klebanov and Strassler here, but you should all realize that there's a long list of papers, most of which were written by Klebanov and someone else. but one of the first papers in this long list was by Klebanov and Witten, which they pointed out that this conifold theory can be thought of as an IR conformal fixed point. You have some parent orbifold theory, some Z2 orbifold of S5, and you add an appropriate mass term, and you can flow to this conifold theory in the IR. So Seiberg said, if you have some gauge theory that sits at an IR fixed point, there's this duality, which takes you to an equivalent gauge theory, which has the same low energy degrees of freedom. So in particular, there's this famous formula. You have SUNC goes to SUNF minus NC, which means that if you take the Seiberg dual of a particular SUN gauge group in that theory, the number of colors changes in this way. So the new number of colors is the old number of flavors minus the old number of colors. So for example, in this conifold theory, we have NF. How many flavors are there? Well, in the previous slide, you saw there were these two A's and two B's, so they're actually twice 2N. 2N flavors, say we look at this gauge group, then there are 2N flavors with respect to this other gauge group. And the number of colors, if we pick one of those gauge groups to dualize, is just N. So 2N minus N is N. So the gauge group rank doesn't change. So the Seiberg dual of the conifold gauge theory is the same theory. In fact, you can check. I mean, it's not just the ranks that don't change. The superpotential doesn't change. Nothing changes. So it's sort of amazing thing about this conifold theory is that the Seiberg dual is essentially the same theory. I'll have to modify that a little bit later on, but that's an important point. Okay. So for those who are interested in other questions, I'd like to also point out that the Seiberg duality is an equivalence in the landscape of string theory vacua. I mean, if you have all of these gauged some holographic notion of you pick some string theory and then it has these holographic duals, then you have to understand Seiberg duality to eliminate or realize that some of these vacua are the same. Okay. So this was all at the conformal point. Now I want to make things non-conformal, make them a little bit more realistic. And how do we do that? We add D5 brains. Before we just had D3 brains, now we add MD5 brains. So sitting at the tip of this cone, they wrap some vanishingly small cycle at the tip of this cone, and the rest of the directions are parallel to the D3 brains. And they don't add to the gauge groups in the same way as the D3 brains do. They just add to one of the gauge groups. So the gauge groups change in this way when you add the 5 brains. And once you do that, you can check that the beta functions are no longer zero. So here I've written the NSVZ beta functions in the slightly unconventional way. So these terms, these first terms, you might recognize as these quadratic Casimirs, which correspond to, say, SUN and SUN plus M. And then there's a bunch of terms that come from the anomalous dimensions, which I've written in terms not of anomalous dimensions, but in terms of R charges. Okay, so why can I do that? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to add just a very small number of d5 brains. So I'm sitting very close to this conformal fixed point. So I have some approximate notion of R charge. And I know at the conformal point, the R charge is related to the conformal dimension by this factor of 3/2 for these n equals 1 theories. And so I can rewrite these beta functions in terms of the R charges. So the question is, what is the R charges? So for this theory, there's a slick and dirty way of getting the R charges. So I said before that the superpotential was quartic in the A's and B's. If I'm at a conformal point, the superpotential has to have R charge 2. So 2 over 4 is 1/2. So it's 1/2. And you can plug in 1/2, and you can get these beta functions. And you can see it's not 0. So I've added d5 brains, and I'm no longer at the conformal point. Any questions? OK, so some of you should be slightly unhappy at this point. You should say, well, I'm not quite at the conformal point. So this is probably not quite true. There should be some corrections. So what should those corrections be? Well, maybe the correction should be, you know, order m over n, since I'm in distance m over n of the conformal point. And if I had m over n corrections here, look, if I plug some n over n correction here, it multiplies this n, and I get some large correction to the beta functions down there. Okay, so that's a worry. So how do I know that I can really trust this? So for the Klebanov-Strassler case, there's this nice Z2 symmetry of the quiver. You can basically flip the quiver back and forth. So the corrections have to be order m squared over n squared. So these, you can actually trust this to the leading order in m. But that's going to be important later on. OK. So we've made this theory non-conformal. Basically, I'm sitting at some large n here. So whether I have sort of n plus m times n or n times n minus m, it's roughly the same. It's an argument you can construct using that fact that you're sitting at large n and you have the Z2 that the correction has to be order m squared over n squared.
Did you use that cyber duality to make that argument? You went from n plus m and n to n and m minus m or n minus m?
Well, there could be additional 1 over n corrections to that, but the leading order correction here is going to be at large n and finite, well, small but finite m over n, it's going to be m over n squared. It's true. And it's basically the fact that you can flip the quiver around and it's the same gauge theory. Okay.
It's not true with
m.
No.
It's essentially true at large n. Okay, so I have this non-conformal theory. And I'm going to pick some initial couplings. So x here is 1 over g squared, 1 over the coupling squared. So I have two couplings, so I have two x's. And on this axis here, I have the logarithm of the RG scale. So I pick some initial couplings, and I let the couplings run by these one loop beta functions. And eventually, the couplings diverge. So x goes to 0 or g goes to infinity. And what Klebanov and Strassler proposed here was that what you do is you take a Seiberg duality. You take the Seiberg dual theory. I'm almost at this conformal point, so there's an almost notion of Seiberg duality. And once I add the d5 brains, the Seiberg dual is not quite the same theory. It's the same theory plus some number of d3 brains. So here I take the Seiberg dual of SUN, because it's this coupling which diverged. And I get this new theory, SUN plus 2m, flowing up into the UV. And the other guy is not changed. And you can see here that sort of the gauge groups change places, so that the beta functions should sort of just switch sign. And then you keep flowing. And the beta functions start flowing the opposite direction. And you keep going along this cascade up and up into the UV. And every time the coupling diverges, you take a Seiberg dual. So one thing I'd like to emphasize here, which won't be true in these more complicated examples, is that these RG steps are all equal in size for KS. That's going to be important for the duality wells. And the second thing is that you may be slightly uncomfortable, like Don is, about these field theory analysis. And you probably should be, but you can trust this because they're these very nice supergravity solutions, these KT and KS solutions, which show you this behavior, more or less, this increase in the number of D3 brains, this change in couplings. So everything seems to be consistent with the gravity dual. Okay. So that brings me to the end of the first half of my talk. Are there any questions before I go on? Okay. So I'm ready to talk about some more complicated examples now. So I want to take X to be the total space of a complex line bundle over a Delpezzo surface. I used to think this sentence had just one meaning, but apparently it has two. Apparently the second meaning is, this was a very interesting introduction, but now it's time to leave because I don't understand the sentence. Well, don't worry. I'm really interested in very simple, concrete examples. So I mean, this is for the benefit of those who want sort of a larger framework in which to put, larger mathematical framework in which to put these examples. The two examples I want to think about are this Herzberg zero surface, which is basically a product of two two-spheres. And if I use this as the starting block for constructing this cone, at the end of the day, I essentially get a Z2 orbifold of a conifold. Okay? And the other example is this DP1, which is P2, complex projective space of dimension 2, blown up at a point. It just means I remove a point and put in a two-sphere. So essentially, I get new points based on which direction I approach that removed point. Okay. So the gauge theory for all of these examples will have four gauge groups. Why is that? So the number of gauge groups basically corresponds to the number of D brains I have in these examples. And the D brains basically correspond to the number of different homology cycles I have in these surfaces. So I have points in these surfaces. Those are going to be D3 brains. I have curves, which wrap, say, one P1 or the other P1. Those are D5 brains in the total space. And I have D7 brains, which wrap, say, the whole surface. So I have two curves in both of these examples, so I have four gauge groups, 1 plus 2 plus 1. So basic problem with these examples is that our gauge theory understanding is not so great. Geometrically, these things are pretty much under control, but gauge theory, you'll see in a moment, is not so well understood. Why do I say that? So let's look at this Herzberg zero surface, this product of two two-spheres. So I said before that for the conifold gauge theory, if I took the Seiberg dual, I got essentially the same theory back, same quiver. Here, I get an infinite tree of theories. Here are just 11 examples of that infinite tree. They all have four gauge groups. So right, you say here, that these blue numbers are the ranks of the gauge groups. So here, for example, you have SU3N cross SUN cross SUN cross SUN. And these numbers, 6, 4, 2, 2, and 6, tell you how many bifundamental fields there are in the quiver. So here are 11 of the simplest Seiberg dual gauge theories, but there are many more, many, many more. So the Seiberg dual is no longer necessarily the same gauge theory. So I hope you've all memorized these colors because it's very important for the next transparency. So this is a picture that was put together by Younghui He, I think, or maybe Seba Franco. And it shows you how to get between those 11 theories I wrote down on the previous transparency by Seiberg duality. So this 3 here means that if you take Seiberg duality of gauge group 3, you get this green theory from this blue theory, and then you can go up Seiberg dualize on node 4, and you get this purple theory, so on and so forth. So it's not quite just that you get, you know, 4 new theories for every theory. There are also loops here, which will be important.
Chris?
Yeah.
In the Kronhoff-Strassler case, you started with the sort of theory which was dual, and then you added a little bit of extra, you know, 5 brains. Now, in this case, are you adding?
I'm going to do exactly the same in a minute.
Oh, in a minute.
In
so
a minute.
Far, this is all.
This is just, say, just at the conformal point, just with D3 brains. If you were to look at the.
Oh, just with D3 brains so far. So all of these gauge groups come with just. I thought you had to add the. All different kinds of brains.
So once I add the D5 brains, I've broken the conformal invariance, and I have sort of a direction in which I can flow naturally. Uh-huh. The beta functions give me, say, a direction which I can flow through this tree. But
you get 4 gauge groups just from D3 brains.
but I get four gauge groups just from the D3 bands. The singularity sort of breaks them up into four different pieces. I can say something else that will make things a little clearer. So we'll see in the future, in the next few transparencies, we'll see some examples of this chaotic renormalization group flow or cascades, which will correspond to just, you know, traveling down some path in this tree. And these KS-type cascades, where you have this increase in the number of D3 brains, these seem to, in our limited experience, correspond to traveling around loops in this tree. But we'll see how this works in a minute. So I have another nice picture here. This is for the second example. And here I've just given you two gauge groups, one with all SUNs and one with an SU2N. And already it's enormously complicated how you get between the different gauge groups. I just point out here these four here, which the example I'm going to look at later on, an important path in which this cascade works will just be to travel around this loop here.
So then what's the difference between given two blue dots here on this diagram?
The dots are the same up to sort of permutation. So you can sort of, you have these four different gauge groups and you can take the Seiberg dual, and so then you have to be careful about whether the gauge groups are in the same order that they used to be. So and after you, since there are only four gauge groups, after you dualize four times, you sort of have to be back where you started because it's the group has only four objects in it. But you can permute the gauge groups.
The numbers of the node.
The numbers on the previous transparency were the node on which you take the Seiberg dual. Okay, so as Gary was asking about, that was just at the conformal point. Now we want to figure out how to travel along this tree. We want to break the conformal symmetry, add some D5 brains, and figure out how the beta functions take us down this tree. So all these theories have N=1 supersymmetry, and they have these four gauge groups, where this DI here I can write as a sum over two vectors. So there's this RI vector, which is the D3 brain vector, and this SI vector, which is the D5 brain vector. And I have N D3 brains and M, D5 brains. I want to keep M very small compared to N, just like before. And all of these examples, I can write the quiver in this nice form. And before going on, I want to introduce this matrix S. So S just gives you a nice way to summarize the information in this quiver. Basically, say if we look at the entry of S1, 2, that means if we look at nodes 1 and 2, there are A bifundamental fields going from 1 to 2. The fact that the arrow is going the opposite direction here means A is negative. Okay. So chiral anomaly cancellation, there's some condition on these quivers that you have, well, with respect to any gauge group, the same sort of right number of right-moving fields as left-moving fermions. So you need the sort of same number of gauge groups going in as gauge groups going out. And that's summarized by this condition here. Okay, so what does that mean? Turns out that S minus S transpose for all of these examples has only rank 2. So there's, one kind of D3 brain and one kind of D5 brain, the two elements of the kernel of S minus S transpose. Okay, so what are the beta functions? I again write the beta functions in the slightly unconventional way in terms of the R charges. And this new matrix S and these ranks, these SUDI, ranks of the gauge groups, DI. But I no longer have this nice slick argument with the superpotential. I don't have this nice symmetry. This quiver on the previous transparency was rather complicated. And it's a little bit more tricky, it's trickier to calculate these R charges. But Johannes and I worked out an answer last summer for the R charges at the conformal point, and they satisfy this formula. So I've written 12 minus 4 in this slightly, I've written 8 in this unconventional way to emphasize the fact that this formula is more general. If you had a Delpezzo gauge theory with 5 gauge groups or 6 gauge groups, you just replace 4 with 5 or 6. So this works more generally for all these Delpezzo gauge theories. And I also would like to emphasize that another way of calculating these R charges was provided last spring by Intrilligator and Wecht, this A maximization principle, which is more general. but also a little bit more cumbersome in this particular instance. You have to write down some cubic polynomial and minimize it. So two issues. The first issue is M over N corrections. So I was emphasizing before that we really need the corrections to these R charges to be of order M over N squared. And the unfortunate factor is that I don't have a very good argument for why the correction should be of that order here.
Does that mean they're not, or you just don't, they are, and you don't know how to argue them?
So, the first thing I'd say is that since the R charges are calculated from some kind of maximization principle, it seems likely that the corrections should be suppressed because you're sitting at the maximum of some function. So we think it's likely that the corrections are suppressed enough so that we can trust these formulas. Another point is that we have some supergravity examples that I'll tell you at the end of the talk where we're sure there are no order M over N corrections, that the corrections are suppressed to order M over N squared. Unfortunately, they're not completely general supergravity solutions. So we're just going to have to hope, but we think we can, that these corrections are suppressed. And the other thing I would say is that even if there were corrections, these very complicated behaviors that I'm about to show you seem somewhat generic. So, so maybe we didn't, calculate these flows quite right, but it seems like even if we had corrections, we'd still see very similar behavior if we knew what the real answer was. And the other thing I'd like to emphasize is that there's this peculiar sum, weighted sum over the beta functions, which is zero, which means that there's some sum over the couplings, which is constant. And in the Klebanov-Strassler example, this had the analogy that the dilaton was constant in the supergravity solution. But through all these flows, there's some constant that's not changing, some sum of the couplings is not changing. Okay. So, the duality wall for the Hertzberg zero surface. I picked some example of that list of 11 gauge theories I showed before. This is the third one, in fact. I calculate the beta functions in the way I just described. And I pick some initial conditions for the couplings, just like in Klebanov-Strassler. And because of the beta functions, you see that this node 2, if I follow the flow back up into the UV, node 2 will be dualized first. And it turns out that if I make X3 large enough, or 1 over G3 squared small enough, or G3 squared small enough, I'll always wind up dualizing on 1 or 2 in this flow. And in fact, the theories I get are summarized in this quiver and these ranks for the gauge groups. So A and B here are either 1 or 2 or 1, depending on the parity of the duality. And you see that the ranks of the gauge groups grow quite large as the number of dualities, K, increases. But M over N, or the ratio of, say, this part of the expression to this part of the expression, remains very small. So you're still close to a conformal point. Okay. So what happens? Well, here's a plot of 1 over coupling versus logs of the RG scale. I pick some initial coupling, 0, 1, 1, 1, and I see what happens. And you get a plot that's similar to the plot I showed before for Klebanov-Strassler, but you notice now that the RG steps get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And in fact, they converge. And provided this X3 was large enough, I find what's called a duality wall when t, at this value of RG scale, where t is equal to this. So that's sort of very curious. Seems to indicate that the field theory is not defined above some UV cutoff scale. So the obvious question is, well, what happens beyond the UV cutoff scale? And I don't really know. There are a number of speculations. There's some singularity in the supergravity solution. You need a full string theory description. There's a little string theory description. But so far, these are just words. And the simple answer is, I don't know what happens. But it's sort of very intriguing. And the other thing I'd like to say before I go on here is that for this particular example of this particular field theory example, I don't have a supergravity dual. This is evidence purely from the field theory side. So
rebutting it if you have a dual?
I haven't found one, or we haven't found one.
But you don't even know what the delta. I mean, you know what the delta is. You know what the.
I sort of know where to look, but I mean, I have supergravity solutions, but they just don't seem to describe this particular field theory behavior.
When you know what the equations are, I mean, you have sort of an ansatz and equations that if you can solve them, give the solution. I mean, how much don't we know the solution?
No, I don't really know. Why I know that I'm supposed to look at this particular Dalpezzo, that you know I should probably build something that's roughly similar to Klebanov-Strassler, but I'll say a little bit more about this at the end. Okay, so this was a duality wall when this X3 was sufficiently large. So you can ask, what happens when I make X3 a little smaller? And this is my favorite picture. This is my favorite picture of the talk.
It's like fractional funnel hollow.
That would be nice.
It's not a plateau.
Yeah, these are not flat. So here I've plotted on this axis, this is the duality wall height, what the UV cutoff scale for this theory is. And here I plotted the initial x3 of 0, the initial coupling strength. And you notice there's this, what happens is that if x3 is smaller, you dualize it. You dualize it eventually. Eventually x3 goes to 0 and you have to dualize it. And you start going down some different chain of dualities in this large tree. And there are these steps. So, I mean, whenever you dualize on x3 a little bit earlier in the cascade, and there are in fact an infinite number of steps, and then it plateaus at that value of the wall I showed on the previous transparency. But it's even more interesting than that. So if you zoom in on all of these convex cusps, you find that they're not really there. They break up. They break up into two new convex cusps and a concave cusp. And you can zoom in again, and they break up again. So you have this weird fractal structure for this duality wall height. And if you want, you can analyze how exactly which nodes you're dualizing and how the chain of dualities changes at each of these cusps. And that's what these little numbers are here and here and here, which you can barely read. But it's sort of a very nice picture. Okay. So that concludes the Hertzberg zero example. And I have another example to show you, which was for this P2 blown up at a point. Okay. So here I choose one of those two theories that was in the tree, the theory that was at the corners with those loop of four. And I calculate the beta functions again. And you notice that there are two beta functions here which are larger than the others, the 27 and the minus 27. So if I choose generic couplings, and I flow either into the IR or the UV, I'll typically dualize on one of these guys first, right? Because they're larger. And in fact, what happens is if I dualize on either of those, I get the same theory back up to some permutation of the nodes. So I travel around that loop of four that I showed you before in the DP1 tree. Okay, so here's another very nice picture. So this was the cover of the transparency, the cover of the talk. This was on the cover of the talk. So what have I done here? On this axis is X3. This is X4. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with some, choice of initial couplings, X2, X3, X4. I'm going to follow the cascade. And every time X2 goes to 0 or G2 diverges, I plot a point on here. So it's sort of like a surface of section plot in mechanics. So you remember, say you have some two-dimensional system with P1, P2, X1, X2. And you plot a point every time, say, one of the momenta goes to 0. You plot the other momenta versus x. You plot the phase space of the other dimension. And if there's some periodic behavior, eventually, these points that you plot on the surface of section often fill out these loops or give other indications that there's some periodic behavior. Or, I mean, if it's more chaotic, you get some more ergodic distribution of points. Okay, the analogy is a little loose because I don't really have an area-preserving map here, but it is a little tantalizing to see some similarity here. So let's look at this one. So you see there are all these nice ellipses here, and in fact there's a fixed point in the center. So if I start out with couplings in the center here, I'll always get back every four dualities to a point where x2 diverges and the other couplings are precisely in the center of this ellipse. And if I start out a little bit on the edge, you know, on one of these ellipses, I'll eventually fill out one of these ellipses. So the colors here, right, the colors just tell you what the initial conditions are. So all the purple guys have the same starting point. And in fact, these ellipses correspond to traveling around that little loop, that little loop in the DP1 tree I had before. And you can actually, you know, analyze this behavior quite well. I mean, you can figure out what those ellipses are. It turns out these ellipses basically correspond to setting up the coupling so that you always dualize on the node with the sort of largest absolute value of the beta function. And after four dualizations, you get like the same quiver and you just travel along this ellipse. So basically C and delta here allow you to start on some position of that ellipse. And then N is the number of dualizations. And beta and theta are just some characteristic of the gauge theory.
I didn't understand what the four different plots were, like were they different Del Platos? They were all equal, right?
Yeah, they're just different initial conditions.
So,
I mean, here, most of the initial conditions were set up in this stable region where there's an ellipse. But if you start out here, you know, you start traveling along some elliptical arc, but eventually x3 or x4 goes to zero, and then you have to start going down some different direction in the tree. And then maybe eventually, if you're lucky, you get back to a new elliptical arc, but with the nodes that are permuted, and then maybe some other elliptical arc.
So the analogous thing in the Klebanov-Strassler solution would just be a straight line.
Yeah, for Klebanov-Strassler, nothing changes. It's just a point, right? You just have these two couplings, and if you want to plot, you want to plot a point whenever one of the couplings diverges, the other coupling is always at some particular value. It's always so I had this diagram before where it looked like this for one of the couplings and like this for the other.
Right.
So you'd just be plotting these points, which are all at the same height. Can people see that? No. Okay, so that brings me to the second half of my talk. How am I doing for time? Is it
okay? You have okay. 20 minutes left.
20 minutes left. Okay, so I can go a little bit more slowly. That's good. So I was saying that the bad news here was that I don't have supergravity duals for these chaotic flows. I don't have supergravity duals for the duality walls, but I do have supergravity duals for KS type solutions. So the solutions where it's nice and regular, where the D3 brains grow as you go up into the UV, and nothing seems to change. You don't reach a wall. There's no sort of funny oscillation in the couplings. So what is this solution that I'm finding? It's essentially this KT solution. This KT solution is essentially a solution that's very similar to the Klebanov-Strassler solution. It's exactly the Klebanov-Strassler solution in the UV and the ultraviolet at large radius or high energy. But it is singular in the IR. Okay. But I mean if you read the literature, you find that the KT solution was discovered before the KS solution, and then eventually people figured out how to fix it. They resolved or they deformed the conifold and they got this nice behaved KS solution. So presumably you can do the same thing here for the KT solution. You can deform the tip of the Del Pezzo and get a similar story about confining gauge theories and so forth. The other thing, other technical point about the solution is it relies on these imaginary self-dual 2,1 forms that have appeared from time to time. In Joe's work with Steve and Shamit. So that's all I want to say about these about the supergravity side without getting too technical. So the field theory looks exactly like this Klebanov-Strassler type cascade where the D3 brains grow as you go up into the UV. And there's really no indication in any of these solutions of any sort of chaotic behavior or any sort of duality wall. Okay.
Now, I mean, in supergravity, because the steps are so, the steps are very close in normalization scale in supergravity regime. So you actually, in the supergravity solution is always behaving smoothly, even while the gauge theory is cascading, right? It's not, I mean, just, so it's not clear how you would see anything happening. Isn't that true?
I think that's essentially true. So you're saying that in the supergravity solution, you need both M and N to be very large. And
right. So what happens, I mean, when the gauge theory cascades, what happens is the flux integrated over the three-sphere goes to an integer value. But nothing local happens. It just happens that you're just passing through a series of integers. Somehow, the cascade gets smeared out. And so even when it's, I don't know, maybe even when it's chaotic, there you wouldn't expect anything.
That could be. That's certainly a possibility.
But a duality wall, you expect to see because something would really just be an end to the flow. That's less.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you could expect some other size of this horizon flow. Finitely. Mm-hmm. Because, for example, the ranks of these gauge groups also goes to infinity.
Although you definitely need
a finite radial distance.
A good way of measuring the degrees of freedom. So something naive like the central charge won't work, but. Okay, so yeah, for the duality walls. Right. So, but one thing that's very nice about these supergravity solutions that we found is that you can check the beta functions that I gave this field theory analysis for before. You can check that they agree precisely with these supergravity solutions. So how do we do that? Well, the first thing you notice about this KT solution is just like the KS solution, the dilaton was constant, so that weighted sum over the beta function should indeed vanish, and it did. And the second thing is that you can look at the gauge couplings that have something to do with the D5 brain. So the D5 brains, in this theory, there should be some gauge theory roughly that lives on it, and what's that coupling? Well, put in a probe D5 brain, integrate over this vanishingly small cycle that it's wrapping, so you reduce it to this 3+1 dimensional effect of field theory. So what do you integrate it over? You integrate this two form over this NS and S2 flux. And this, roughly speaking, should be, you know, the inverse coupling of the gauge theory. And you know precisely what this NS and S2 form is in the Klebanov-Zeitlin solution. It's just some function of, you know, the string tension, the string coupling, a logarithm of the radius of the cone. And we have these phi I, which are cycles which are Poincaré dual to these vanishing cycles, the D5 brain wraps. And in these more general cases, you don't just have one D5 brain. You may have many. So there's M with an index I for all the different D5 brains that you could have, all the different curves you could wrap. So you just calculate this. You integrate up this NS and S2 form over this cycle. And this is really thanks to Johannes, who worked most of the details out here. The general you just identify this inverse coupling with this weighted sum over the beta functions, just like we did for the dilaton. And they match precisely. So apparently, there are no M over N corrections here to these beta functions. At least when we have this KS type cascade, when there's no duality wall or other weird behavior. Okay, so that's for the geometry. And I also can say a little bit about a paper I'm about to write, or have written and about to put out, I think, maybe sometime next week, about trying to understand all of these different gauge theories. So we have this enormous tree of Seiberg dual theories. How do you characterize it? So one way of organizing all these gauge theories is using this exceptional collection technology, which was suggested in a paper by Cacciazzo, Fiol, and Trilligator, Katz, and Baffa. Later worked out in much more detail by Winholt. And it turns out that this is a very useful construction to organize these gauge theories. And there are a number of properties that, in this light, all of these gauge theories satisfy. One of these is well split, which is something I made up and I'll tell you a little bit more about it next transparency. But basically, it means that if the gauge theory is well split, you have this nice definition of Seiberg duality in terms of mutations of these exceptional collections. So you have this alternate mathematical definition of Seiberg duality in terms of mutations if the gauge theory is well split. Another nice property that all these gauge theories satisfy is something called strongly exceptional, which is basically a way of constructing a quiver from one of these exceptional collections. And if it's strongly exceptional, this method of constructing a quiver basically makes sense in a mathematical context. And another condition on the types of maps, this X12 condition on the exceptional collection, basically tells you that you have the right types of fields in the gauge theory. There are no bifundamental fields, gauge fields. So this paper I'm writing is essentially, just to give you a little bit of an advertisement, not really to explain very much, is a proof that condition 2 is equivalent to condition 3, and they both imply condition 1, and that Seiberg duality can sort of consistently be defined in this exceptional collection language. So let me say one little more thing about well-split, and then wrap up. So well-split is kind of an interesting notion. It essentially means what? So here are some gauge theories with 5 gauge groups, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, with generic bifundamental matter between all the gauge fields. And there's this some superpotential for these theories, which basically has to correspond to some loop in this quiver, right? The superpotential you have to trace over all the color degrees of freedom, so it's gauge invariant. So it's some trace over a loop. So the thing about this well-split condition is that every possible superpotential term, every possible loop, has to respect that ordering, has to respect the cyclic ordering of the gauge theories. So for all Del Pezzo gauge theories, seems that all of the superpotentials have to respect this well-split. All the superpotential terms have to respect the cyclic ordering. The well-split condition basically means there's some cyclic ordering such that if I put a point at some point inside some polygon in this quiver, all of the arrows around here will travel counterclockwise around that point. So it's a nice pictorial picture of well-split. Okay. So that's roughly some first step towards organizing all of those Seiberg dual theories. So that brings me to the end of my talk. So I hope I've given you some flavor for this chaotic and fractal behavior for these Del Pezzo gauge theories. And I hope you're also interested and excited by these duality walls. Although I'm sorry I don't have supergravity duals of these duality walls to sell to you today. Maybe sometime in the future. Another thing I'd like to mention is that there may be some interesting connection to this work of Thibaut d'Amour et al. On these cosmic billiards. So you wonder, because there's this alternate notion of Seiberg duality, some kind of vial reflection. And similarly, Thibaut d'Amour and these Kasner types, supergravity solutions have found these vial reflections to generate this chaotic behavior. And so that's sort of an interesting line of inquiry maybe to pursue in the future. And then what's point 4 and 5? Just that, well, the supergravity solution at least puts these chaos type cascades on a firm footing for all Del Pezzos. Although the duality walls and the chaotic behavior need more study from a supergravity perspective. And finally, I think a lot more work needs to be done to understand these trees, to try and characterize, find if there's any information in these trees, such as this well-split. This well-split characteristic. Thanks very much. Gary.
So I realize I'm confused about something really simple. So when you do your beta function flows, you're starting at the infrared, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're somehow flowing to higher energy.
Right, so I'm reconstructing a flow that hopefully at one point started its life in the UV.
I see, so you're sort of flowing back. But, and then you get the duality wall at some energy and you don't know what happens at higher energy or something like that.
Right.
On the supergravity side, it's the large radius solution, which is presumably well understood and looks like this Klebanov statement solution. And then you flow in and it's singular.
But that's the opposite, right? Because a large radius in ADS is a UV description. So that's a description which is well, you know, understood or supposed to be described in the high energy gauge theory.
Right.
So what's the connection? And why are you seeing agreement between some large radius ADS behavior and some low energy gauge theory behavior?
So I guess the simple, the first thing to say is just that if I had some field theory analysis which produced, you know, some KS type cascade where, you know, these regular steps back up into the UV where the number of D3 brains increase. So say for example that picture, that DP1 example, if I looked at the point in the center of that ellipse, it's perfectly regular. All the steps are roughly the same size, and after, I mean, I just sort of step my way back up into the UV. That's essentially, there I would expect the things to match because I'm going to have some nice description in the UV. So you're suggesting that maybe this KT solution is the wrong place to look for these other examples where I don't expect a UV completion. That, I think, yeah, that's a valid point. But you may want to look somewhere else. Or maybe it doesn't. The other possibility is that we're fooling ourselves with this field theory analysis, that you really can't push this field theory analysis quite as far as we did. So maybe there aren't duality walls, at least in this context.
They're always in the UV direction.
Okay, so this is something that's a little bit confusing to me. So one problem that happens when you go back to the IR is that the number of these D5 brains typically grows with respect to the number of D3 brains. So then you can't really trust, you really can't trust the field theory analysis. But I think, I think the naive answer is yes, that you can find this behavior in the IR.
No, right. So it has a, there are lots of interpretation, right? In which, right. I mean, if you have a theory which is good in the UV, then whatever it does in the IR is physics. For us.
So, just a simple question about the original Plotinoff stress theory case. So what is the signature in the supergravity dual of being on one side of a duality transition versus being on the other? How is that reflected?
How do you see whether you've last dualized on node 1 or node 2?
If I'm slowly moving through a supergravity solution, how do I know when I've had to dualize and pass through a transition?
So you know because the integral of this NS and S2 form is some integer. But other than that,
So this integer actually changes as I go from one area to another?
No, it goes through, it's a continuous thing that goes through an integer. One consequence is that
why is it not a conserved charge? Or why is this not like usual charges? Like
there's a charge density. The push has a charge density. And this is the flux interior.
Oh, so there's no linear terms in the NSR, the NS and S and the one-on-one fields.
Is this a Chern-Simons term effect? Or is
it's a Chern-Simons term effect.
It's a Chern-Simons term effect. Okay, so this is simply not one of the conserved charges, it's just the integral of flux. Okay.
Now, I mean, is it true that there'll be some kind of probe whose mass goes to zero at that point? I'm not sure. If you can wrap a brain and its mass proportional to the... I'm not sure. There might be some way to take a brain... In some kind, that's right, I'm confused by what it is, I don't know. In the n equals 2 analog of Seiberg duality, there is really something that happens there if you put the right kind of probe in, its mass goes to zero, but I'm not sure the same thing happens for n equals 1.
Is that right?
Yeah. And that's true in the gravity dual?
Yeah, so in the gravity dual, it's like the enhanced odd where some kind of probe would go to zero if the radius of the dual happens. But I don't think that happens. I don't think the same thing happens for the n equals 1 cyber duals. I think they're really pretty smooth as far as any physical observable.
I think they're smooth. I mean, something that I've been trying to think a little bit about with Johannes is to see if there's some way of understanding these cyborg dualities in terms of the masses or the stability of rat brains in this geometry.
Well, if there are no more questions, let's see.